You're listening to TCRG to CEO Radio with your host, Courtney J., TCRG.
Hey everyone, Happy New Year and welcome back to TCRG to CEO Radio. I'm your host, Courtney J., and we are kicking off the new year with an amazing, amazing episode with three new adjudicators. They're all celebrating their one-year anniversary of hitting the fesh scene on the official side of the table where scores matter, opinions matter, and I'm so excited to share this episode with everyone. As a reminder, you can follow along on my Instagram account, CourtneyJTCRG, and that's linked down in the show notes. That way you can click on it directly. And a lot of the questions that I posed to our adjudicators were sourced from a question box on my Instagram story. This episode became so long that it is a two-parter. So part one of this episode will come out right now. And if you're listening as it launches, you'll be able to listen to part two next week. And we cover a lot of super popular questions, a lot related to costuming, choreography, lots of different myths or urban legends of the Irish dance scene at large. And you'll get to hear from these three adjudicators whether certain things matter or not. So please enjoy this episode, and I look forward to releasing part two next week. All right, we are lucky to have three adjudicators that are celebrating 1 year of passing their exam. We have Ryan McComb, Becky Chapman, and Casey Costello with us today. Thank you all for your time. And who would like to start with making an introduction?
I could jump on in. And Ryan volunteered me as well. Hi, everyone. My name is Casey Costello. As Courtney mentioned, I recently passed my AD exam last year. I took my exam in Calgary in September 2022. And then we found out the results in late 2023. Or sorry, 2022. Sorry. So I started dancing when I was 12. With the Bernadette Short School of Irish Dance. And then I competed until I was 27. And then from there, I went to get my TCRG exam. I passed my TC exam in 2014 in Toronto. A year after that, I opened my own school, Costello Irish Dance. We're based in a suburb of Montreal, Canada. And then after my original plan was to get my to pass my AD exam in 2020. That was my New Year's resolution for 2020. And then, Becky too. So anyways, that was sidelined for a few years, but fortunately I got to get in at one of the first exams that were open. And so got into Calgary and then passed. And so I've been judging for 1 year and so far absolutely love it.
Awesome, congratulations. Who's next?
I can go. So my name's Becky Chapman. I'm Canadian. I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia. I started Irish dancing a little bit later than most people. I took my first lesson when I was 12 and I didn't fesh for the first time until I was 14. But competed, made it to open champ. And then after university, I moved to Dublin for a year, just a year abroad. So growing up, I danced with Beth and Sinead Green. And when I moved abroad, I took exam prep lessons from Molly Farrelly, and I danced with the late Colette Cook. And then I took a few kicks at the can for my TC exam. So anybody who's studying, keep going. Once you get it, nobody asks how many times you did it. So I passed that in 2013. Like Casey, I tried to do my adjudicators in 2020. I sat down to side judge with somebody for the first time in February 2020, the end of the month, and then 2 weeks later, decided to give up on that dream, and then got back on the circuit and passed my AD with these guys in Calgary, and have been doing fesh and a few school fesh since then. And it's fab. It's the best gig ever.
All right. I guess I'll hop in here. Ryan McComb, third time on the podcast. Throwback to Courtney's earlier episodes. If you want to go back in the history and listen back, started dancing in 1997 with the late Margaret Pike. Also spent some time with the late Gary Healy and ended with with Aaron Pender and Kathleen Keady at the Harney Pender Keady Academy. Taught for a number of years in both the Mid-America region and the New England region, passed my TCRG in 2014, and then passed my AD with these fine folks in September of last year. I am not actively teaching. I did not go back after the pandemic, so I am at the moment adjudicating at large, which has been sort of a fun exercise as well, just to be in a position to, you know, be in potentially more places with fewer potential entered dancer conflicts, which at this stage I think has been helpful. But I look forward to a productive dialogue. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Yeah, I love this, you know, cast that you got together for us, Ryan. And we're talking a little bit about how to take that next step of your career. Maybe someone like me who is getting there and maybe wants to take it soon-ish, maybe. What did you do to prepare for your exam, and what was the most challenging part of the exam for you?
I don't mind going first. So I started studying in 2020. The first thing I did was go to a FESH and kind of sit side saddle with some other adjudicators. And I think this is, some people love this, some people don't prefer it. The pro is you get so much knowledge from the person you're sitting with. The con is that you're really putting yourself out there, and it's really obvious that you're studying, and that's, you know, sometimes you might want to keep that private. It's a pretty stressful exam. But I know for me, I wanted to eliminate as many unknowns as possible. So the thing I found most helpful was just talking to everybody I could. So that was when I was sitting with somebody at a FESH, but I would just chat with people on Messenger or in person about their exam experience. We had a really great study group that we were all a part of, and we would meet weekly on Sundays. And now, thanks to some of the online opportunities, we would always find a video to watch. We'd each mark 20 dancers, and then we'd grill each other about our marks and our scores. So it forced you to practice, but it also forced your interview skills to get better, especially because you were talking to your peers, which is even more uncomfortable, I think. So that was huge. The Kaylees probably took the longest. I don't know if I would say it was the hardest, but it took the longest to memorize. So I probably spent a good 7 or 8 months getting ready. Found getting ready for the AD harder than the TC, because you're also, or at least for me, running your own school and doing all of those. Yeah, that has to take precedence sometimes over your own studying. So it was a bit more sporadic. But definitely for me, number one was talking to people and getting their experience.
I love that.
If I can just hop in, it's Ryan McComb here. I'd almost encourage everyone to think of the exam actually as two different things. And Casey or Becky, if you disagree with me here, you know, feel free to. But there's the exam part, right? There's the music, there's the written, there's the math that you just study for. And as much time, look, different people study at different rates. Some people can cram the book in 6 weeks. Some people need 6 months. Some people need multiple years. That part is, take as much time as you need to take. You know what kind of test taker you are. It is what it is. But the second piece, the practical, the FESH piece of this, isn't an exam in the sense that there are right answers and wrong answers. It's a job interview. Yeah. So with that in mind, like, I almost want to separate the two parts and go, like, there's the study piece. It doesn't matter how long someone else took to study for it. It only matters who you are and what you're going to need to study and memorize those things. But the other piece, like, I found it extremely valuable. I did put myself out there over and over and over again at multiple FESHNA and sat with adjudicators and had dialogues with them and asked them questions and tried to figure that out, because that job interview piece is something, again, there aren't right answers and wrong answers. There are your answers and your defense of those answers. And talking to other adjudicators really helped me start to understand. I realized I got it when another adjudicator looked at me after a round and said, oh yeah, of course you would have that dancer first, because I know you like X, Y, and Z when you look at dancers. And you're like, all right, cool. I'm now consistent enough that I've got some, you know, some clarity around this. So when I think, you know, in terms of preparation, I kind of think of those two things as two separate things. I don't know, Becky or Casey.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Ryan and I sat together in the written portion of the exam, and we both left the Kaylee portion of the exam basically at the halfway mark, We got ridiculed endlessly at dinner that night. But yeah, that part is just like, that's a school test. I took 8 months to study it. But if you know the Kaylee, you know the Kaylee. If you know the music, you know the music. That's not gray. And then, yeah, spent much more time. There's far more unknowns in the AD part of it.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in here. So the application to the exam was in late June for the exam in September. And I actually only really started to prepare once I knew I had my spot. So I had about 2.5 months to prepare. I fully agree with Ryan that there's the sort of school test side of the exam, and then there's the job interview side of the exam. I'm pretty good at memorizing. And I run a school. I really love team, so we do a lot of team dancing. And I come from a school that was big on team dancing, so I'm quite lucky to have done a lot of Kaylees and been exposed to a lot of Kaylees. So what I decided to do, because I only had 2.5 months, was to focus 90% of my energy on the mini fesh and my judging and the interview after, to how you rationalize your judging and how you defend it, because I felt that I could probably get by on the fact that I'm pretty good at memorizing and I have a lot of experience with the written Kaylees. With that said, there was only 2.5 months, and in Eastern Canada, there's not that many feshes in general, and there's certainly not many in the summer. And there was only two in our region from the time I got into the exam. And one of them was in Montreal, so every single one of my dancers was in it, and it would make no sense for me to shadow, so I didn't do that. And then the second fesh was in Toronto, and it was on a weekend that I couldn't go, so I only shadowed once, not in our region, in Syracuse, New York, which is pretty close by. But the drawback to that was that it was 1 week before. It was less than a week, actually. It was the Saturday before the exam, and I was leaving for the exam on the Wednesday. And I went and I did the shadowing, and it was amazing. And there was so much help that I got. I shadowed three different adjudicators. There was so much help and so much advice that they gave me. The unfortunate reality was that my exam was in 5 days, so I couldn't really implement a lot of their advice because I already had my system that I had to kind of rely on. I wasn't about to totally revamp my system based on what they said. So if I were to redo it again, I would try to go to as many feshes as possible and shadow as much as possible earlier on, much earlier, so that I could actually implement their advice into the system that I developed. So because I didn't have much shadowing, I relied on our study group, like Becky had mentioned. It was very, very helpful. A lot of online videos. So Fesh TV was my best friend. There's a lot of even Fesh videos on YouTube that you can find. There's like a Vienna Fesh that I used that was very helpful. But Fesh TV was probably the most useful, just because you have all the ages, and you have all Kaylees from the North American Championships, which had just finished. And we had those videos all summer to practice on and to quiz each other on. And so that was very, very useful. The last thing I would say is the whole time I was feeling like I wasn't ready and feeling like I hadn't done enough, which I think a lot of people often feel that feeling. And for whatever reason, because normally I love a clean desk and I don't love clutter. But for whatever reason, I kept all my practice judging sheets. And by the end, about a week before the exam, I realized I had like a stack massive of judging. And I went and counted it. And I literally had hundreds of practice, of times that I practiced judging. So as long as you can stand clutter, I would say keep all your practice judging sheets, because it's literally proof that you've worked really hard on this. And it was proof that I went to the first ones, which were diabolical. I was all over the place. And then I went to the most recent, and I was like, oh, I'm actually consistent now. And so I would say keep all your judging sheets, because it will prove to you that you've worked really hard and prove to you that you're ready. Yeah, that's about all I have to say.
Awesome. Well, thank you all. If we were going to talk about the interview for a second, what would be the number one tip that you gave someone going into the interview? Just one.
I feel like the number one thing people told me is just stick to your guns. If your assessment is different than theirs, it doesn't mean it's wrong. So just be confident in yourself and what you assess people at. Confidence doesn't have to be arrogance or argumentative, but just be sure of yourself. You gave that mark or that comment for a reason. So just kind of have faith in yourself.
I would say be professional. But with that, there's a few subpoints. Can I add the subpoints?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Number one, look good. Look amazing. Look your absolute best.
God, and you so did, Case.
Thank you, Becky. We all did. We all look good at our exam. But I walked into my exam, to the interview part, had a new suit, had a new briefcase, and I walked in smiling. I was nervous, but I was smiling. And the examiner looked at me and said, "A briefcase and a smile. That's all you need." Awesome. And I don't think she actually meant it literally. I think you need a bit more than that. But what she meant was, if you read between the lines, she meant was, you're taking this seriously. You're looking the part. You're looking like a representative of CLRG, which is what we want. So that's number one, of being professional. And then number two, it touches on what Becky said. Don't disagree with them. Don't argue with them if they disagree with you. Just stick to your guns and say, "Well, I saw it this way." You're not telling them that they're wrong. You're just saying, "I'm right too." So those would be, it would be professional, as professional as you could possibly be.
And I'll just go one other way here, which is like, be a colleague as well. Be a human. You know, I know, like, I by the way, I 100% like, first take Becky's advice, second take Casey's advice, but then, you know, to the extent you've got mental energy left, maybe take mine, which is like, over the course of our conversation, we laughed a couple of times. I had used the word munchkin. One of the examiners said to me, you know, "Do you remember this dancer?" And I said, "Yeah, she was the, you know, little munchkin. She had glasses and a pink dress." And the examiner looked at me and went, "Munchkin?" I was like, "Oh, I have to define the word munchkin." All right. Yes, little girl, blonde hair, you know, pink dress, et cetera. And we had a good laugh about it because, you know, two of the other examiners looked at this examiner and sort of went like, "You've never heard that word before." And for a moment, we were actually all on the same side of the table. We were all having a laugh together. And remember, the part of the part of this that is a job interview is that the following week or the following month, you could be sitting at a table with your examiners all judging the same event. So they're looking at you, trying to find somebody that they want to be colleagues with. And that means presenting yourself as a colleague. It means presenting yourself, you know, the way Becky talked about and the way Casey talked about, but it also means, hey, is this someone that I'm going to want to sit with as a colleague a week from now? So it's okay to be a human too.
I think that is a perfect, I think it went in the perfect order too. That's great. All right. So you guys have been sitting at the table now for a year or some little more, some little less, I guess. And then what is your favorite level to judge so far?
I can jump on this one. Preliminary.
Okay.
Preliminary championship is my favorite level to judge, hands down.
Casey's making bug eyes at you.
Casey looked at me like, "Are you crazy?" And everyone does, by the way. I'm like the only human who likes judging preliminary championship most.
All right, so you have to tell us why.
I think why a couple of things, right? One is when I was teaching, I always found the most rewarding sort of times and levels to teach was kind of the intermediate phases. Like, if I'm honest with you, I never really loved judging open teaching open champs. And I'm not really good with beginners. I was always really gratified by and rewarded by those levels, the novice, the prize winners, and the preliminary champions, where you could see really meaningful progress over, you know, over a period in terms of skills. And I really enjoy, like, first, like, I'll tell you, look, like, preliminary champions tend to come in two forms. Those that are quite close to open championships and those that have a long way to go. But I feel like I can be most useful to those dancers in providing feedback to help get them there and rewarding those who are close. And therefore, I find it most rewarding to judge preliminary championships, but I also find it most enjoyable to kind of watch for those dancers who are close and you know, you can kind of see the work they've put in judging those competitions. So that's my opinion that apparently nobody shares, but here we are.
That's what we're here for.
But it's a good opinion and it's a good perspective that I will take with me when judging a preliminary competition. Sure. I just find it a really challenging competition to judge. That's why. It's not that I dislike it. It's more that it makes me really have to work really hard to get clear on what I'm looking for in those.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Right, like a favorite. Hard
in that way.
My favorite part would be, it would be either the champs or the beginners. It's like opposite ends of the spectrum. My favorite is when I do both and I get to see both in the same fest day. The beginners, I love to see the future of Irish dance. I love to see how proud they are of themselves. I love to feel the energy of their entourage, because you have a five-year-old whose parents and siblings and aunts and uncles and grandparents, and they have like an entourage of 25 people all behind me. And it's so much fun to feel their energy and to see the parent's face when the kid comes off stage and the parent is so proud and the kid is so proud. So I love judging beginners for that. And I love seeing the future. And then the champs, it's like, it's almost seeing the future again, because you see the new stuff that the champs are doing that you haven't necessarily seen before. And they're the ones pushing the boundaries. They're the ones sort of leading the evolution of the sport. So I love judging that too. Those would be my faves.
We'll all be different. I actually genuinely love everything. And there would be nowhere you could assign me that I'd be put off or unhappy. I'll do any age, any level. And I mean that genuinely. Like I've said to a few people after judging, like, this is the best gig. Because you just sit and watch dancing all day and it's amazing. Probably my favorite is like advanced beginner novice, because I feel like those dancers often are new enough into dancing that they're actually just having so much fun. Like their smiles are so earnest and genuine. And they're just like, this is incredible. I'm out for the weekend. I'm going to have a hot dog. Like life's fab. But they're far enough along they know they're competing and they so genuinely want to impress you. And it's like so fun. Sometimes they'll dance and they're doing a spin, but they're still looking at you with their eyes, even though they shouldn't be twisting their heads. And like, I don't know, there's just something there. They're still so happy and in love with Irish dance. It hasn't been spoiled by competition. Not that competition's spoiling, but there's an innocence there. But they want it enough that you feel like this ethereal human that's like gonna change their life. So just makes me feel special.
Aw, that's great. Do you have any funny stories of your time judging so far? I don't know, costume mishap, you know, something.
I had a kid dance happening for me. This was at Casey's Fesh, actually. It was in March and it was St. Patrick's Day theme, and he dressed up as St. Patrick for the treble reel. And I will say, this was my one unethical adjudicating. I gave him third based on his costume alone. His treble reel was all right. And I still gave first and second to the best treble reelers. But I just wrote like capital yes in his comments. But it was a treble reel. The spirit of it was dressing up and participating in this. He had a wooden stick. Like he was the best.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the St. Patrick's theme treble reel. And he like took the St. Patrick's theme to like the nth degree. I remember that costume. It was phenomenal.
Anyone else with a funny story that they want to share? All right.
I've done turn and oak a few times, and that's just funny because sometimes they stay on stage, sometimes they don't stay on stage. Sometimes they move, sometimes they don't move. It's always funny.
Ryan, were you about to jump in?
No, agreed. That's I haven't had any mishaps of note yet, but I okay. have. They're coming.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they're coming. Mm-hmm. All right, we had a lot of submissions related to costuming, speaking of that treble reel. So I think it boils down to a lot of people want to know, how much does the look matter to you? Because again, we're here to have possibly different opinions or just share different perspectives, since every judge is different. How does it impact your first impression and first impression only? We'll start there.
My first impression is always how the dancer walks on and how they hold themselves at the back of the stage before the music starts. So that's always my first impression. And I've had dancers in $4,000 costumes catch my attention with their confidence, and I've had dancers in blackout catch my attention with their costumes, with their confidence, sorry. It's really, excuse me, it really comes down to confidence. So to me, it's confidence and energy. If the costume makes you feel amazing, then I guess it does help, because it makes you feel a bit more confident and your energy is a bit more of like, yeah, I got this and I'm going to attack this dance. And that's what I love to see. But that's my first impression when it comes to the dancer. It's always about confidence and their general energy and their general excitement to be on stage and to show us what they have. Once they start dancing, I really focus in on the legs, and the posture. So I'm kind of like down, up, down, up, down, up, as far as my watching them is concerned. I would just say, if the costume doesn't serve them, then it doesn't help with their mark. So
what mean poor fit, that, distracting element, something like that.
Distracting element, or some dresses will, I don't know, maybe they're constructed a certain way that they just have trouble getting their arm by their side than if they were in something a bit smaller or less restrictive. So then their arms are out, and posture, I'm really big on posture.
And I was going to say, if anybody ever has Casey sitting at their table, tuck your arms in and tuck them in further.
Yeah. So yeah, I would just say, if the costume doesn't help you achieve the proper technique, then it's not going to help out.
Okay.
So that could be a $4,000 costume, or it could be blackout too. It doesn't matter.
I'm just going to say, I think, Casey, I think that is the answer. Everything you just said, like, that is the answer to how the costume impacts the dancing. It is a part of your performance to the extent that it helps you feel more confident, that it helps you show the proper technique. But no one is sitting there going, do they have the look? Is that a part of my mark? It's not. I think you nailed it.
Yeah, I agree. To me, costumes don't make a stick of difference. And I think I disappoint some of my dancers when we're out at the fashion. They might, oh, did you see that? Or, oh, you know, no. Saying I don't care sounds too harsh, but it's not something that I pay a ton of attention to. I will caveat, though, there are some buts there, of course. I think a costume needs to be well-fitted, and I don't mean snug, but just fits you. It's not too big, it's not too small, and well-proportioned, because those things can actually make your dancing look worse. If it's too big in the shoulders, you might look like your shoulders are rounding forward. If it's so long and I can't see the cross in your upper leg, that's hampering how your technique looks. So I think those things are important because they're tangibly impacting your technique. Whether it's gorgeous or not, I don't really care. I will say, though, and I don't think I would mark somebody for this. This would be if you're right on the bubble, or again, going back to that first impression. I do expect dancers to present themselves according to the event. So I would not be impressed if somebody stood in front of me at a fesh or a major in what they would wear to dance class. I don't think that's appropriate for the event or respectful of the event. That said, I think you can do that with a ponytail in your hair and no makeup on still. It doesn't have to be that, but I do expect dancers, you're on stage, you're at a performance, we are working, you know, dress appropriately, but I think that can be, that could be slacks and a lovely top. That doesn't have to be bespoke costumes. So yeah, short answer, I don't care. Long answer, respect the event and make sure it fits you.
Okay. I like that. That transitions well to the next one, which is blackout attire or blackout fesh. Does it change the way you score or look at dancers?
Nope.
I think no, but I'm going to throw a thing out here, and Casey and Becky, feel free to disagree with me. I think there are a lot, there's this idea, and you see it out on Irish dancing social media, that somehow blackout is more fair, right? That somehow adjudicators are swayed by how expensive your costume is or who made it or what the look is. And this idea that it would be more fair somehow if everybody wore blackout attire. And I'm not convinced that that's the case. And I'm not convinced that that's the case for a few reasons. And I'll throw them out and feel free to disagree with me here, right? One is, as we've just talked about, the costume is there to serve the dancer. And so if that's the way the adjudicators are approaching it, then it doesn't matter if it's a blackout dress or a beautiful bespoke $4,000 rhinestone dress. It's either there to serve the dancer or it's not. We just discussed this, right? The second thing is, especially in larger competitions, you have to remember that you're asking the adjudicators to remember a large number of dancers. And I'll let you in on a secret here. We're using notes. Those notes might be, and they often are, pink dress, glasses. Remember, like harking back to my Munchkin discussion earlier, right? I had notes for this. Those notes help you when you're watching it, you know, this dancer in the blue dress. All right, I'm watching them. I'm thinking back, were they better than or below? You know, they're kind of close to that dancer in the pink dress. Where do I want to place them? And I think having some differentiation actually helps adjudicators get to a more fair result by helping us remember dancers more clearly. If you put everybody in blackout and there's, you know, 15 brunette dancers in blackout attire in a row, it is actually really hard to remember everybody specifically, especially in a larger competition. And as a result, you're getting the score that is my gut reaction, as opposed to a reflective score. There might be merit to that, but I think a reflective score is probably a better ranking assessment. And therefore, I think one potential downside of blackout is it makes people harder to differentiate, especially in a larger competition. So that's my perspective on it. In a mixed competition, it makes no difference. In an all blackout competition, I actually think it makes it harder to judge, not more fair. Casey or Becky, feel free to disagree if you do.
I agree 100%. I don't think I don't see it as more fair. I agree about the differentiation, especially as the groups get larger. It helps to remember who is who and to be more objective in your judging rather than just a subjective gut reaction. So I agree 100%.
Yeah, I think I do too. It wouldn't make a difference to me. That said, I also feel like the, I guess, more glamorous costuming has almost become so homogenous anyway. Like, everybody's got a unique dress, but everybody does, so nobody really stands out. You know, it's all almost, if you wear blackout in an open competition when everyone else is in rhinestones, you stand out. I don't mind. And it's similar to competitions for gents when they're all wearing slacks. Their costuming is already kind of similar. So yeah, but I agree with the fellas. It doesn't make a difference. It is harder to remember people, so it's more challenging for the adjudicator, but that's fine. We're being compensated. Like, bring it on.
Okay.
End of sentence.
So next one, there's a lot of chatter, you know, in the Irish dance world, and even amongst our rule book, seems like it's always changing. Name identifiers, be it school or personal name, on costumes. Discuss.
You go right in there, Courtney. So for me, I'm not a fan. I don't do it in my school, but that said, kind of like we've already said, I wouldn't pay attention to it anyway. So I'm not taking in the design on your dress or vest if it's from the Book of Kells, nor am I taking it in that you've got this certain bedazzle that everybody else in the comp has. I'm not into it, but I'm not, it's just a no factor for me.
Okay.
For me, I don't mind it. Full transparency, I have it for my school. I recently implemented it, and I implemented it more because I kept getting the same question over and over and over again, and I didn't know how to answer the parents. It was for a headpiece specifically. What do we do for the headpiece? And I didn't know how to answer it. And I struggle in general with costume questions from girls to provide guidance. Like and even when I danced, it's like the lads, we just wore like a standard shirt and a vest. It wasn't as costumey as it is now. So I've never given a ton of thought to solo costumes. And then when I had a school, I was forced to do it. And so I approached a designer and asked them to design a school headpiece. It doesn't have my name. It's just a reference to the school. So it blends in with pretty much every single solo costume. So a lot of people don't even know that we have.
I did. I noticed it.
Okay. Well, thank you. but again, it's like a lot of them. So in the Irish dance world, there's a lot of people who know everything about every dancer and everything about every school. I'm not one of those people. It's like, I don't actually know a school identifier is a school identifier until, honestly, it's like either someone tells me or it's already going out. It's like, I remember the first one that came to my attention, they were already on to their second or third school identifier before I clued into the first one. So I don't think it actually impacts anything because there's so many schools. It's so hard to keep track of what each school is doing, at least for me. For some people it might be easier, but for me, it's like, I don't even know what the school identifiers are. And so I don't think it actually impacts. I don't think it makes a real difference.
Yeah, that's fair. Ryan, I'm going to cut you off. I think sometimes too, in Irish dancing, we focus on the wrong problem.
Yep.
Yeah.
A costume identifier isn't an issue unless there are unethical adjudicators marking dancers. You know, I find this a lot with our rules around adult dancers when they weren't allowed to show their legs. That's not a problem. The problem is people who have issues with other people's bodies. And sometimes I think we try and fix the wrong end of a problem. We need to focus on fixing unethical adjudication or people acting without integrity more than we need to fix what children and grownups are wearing at a performance. Although, I mean, I'm still not a fan. That doesn't change it, but if you have good ethics, it shouldn't matter.
That's extremely well said. And just like, I'll tell a story here. I think for anyone who's listening, who's been to any North Americans in the last 10 years or Mid-Atlantic or New England or Rocktish, you will know, I read the results at most of these a lot of days. So I'm very familiar with top dancers, their names, their schools. I read them out. I look at them on stage every year and have for the last 10 years. So I pretty much know a large number of the top dancers anyway. And look, as a result, just a couple of months ago, sort of before the Oireachtas time, I judged, it was an under 12 open championship competition with about 12 girls in it. And where normally you would denote, you know, pink dress, blue dress or whatever, I could have put the names beside every one of those under 12 dancers. I just knew them all, right? Again, I've been, you know, in and around the region announcing results for years. I taught in the same region, etc. Like, I just knew them all. And it is still possible to fairly judge a competition of 12 dancers that you know. And yes, I knew who the regional champion was. Yes, I knew who the world qualifiers were. And did the result come as a massive surprise? No, not especially, but I judge the dancing on the day. It is entirely possible to fairly judge the dancing on the day, even if you know every dancer in the competition. So with that in mind, if you put your name or your school identifier in the back of the dress, it kind of makes no difference. Like, to me, I might know your name anyway. That doesn't mean I'm not going to judge your dancing on the day.
Okay. Another discussion point, mixed competitions, meaning boys and girls together. any level, doesn't matter. Do you face any challenges trying to judge both at once, or not at all?
If you don't mind me jumping in just one more time, I've recently sort of thought about this because I was speaking to a friend of mine who was, I guess their dancers were very worried about quote unquote boy points, right? I think we've all heard about boy points, that adjudicators award points to boys because they're boys, because we want to encourage more boys or something. And I sat there and I went, I don't think I do this, but I was trying to figure out why, like what could be leading to this? And I think we socialize dancers differently based on gender on average. And then in a FESH environment, in a mixed competition, that has an impact. And Casey's now looking at me like, I want to hear this. So please feel free to argue with me if you disagree. I think we socialize our female dancers, girl dancers, to be a very wide-ranging mix of light on their feet and high on their toes and rhythmic and graceful and all these, you know, variety of things. But we socialize our boy dancers, our male dancers, to be extremely rhythmic and loud and timing and rhythm oriented, almost to the exclusion of all other things. And you have to remember that a competition is two rounds of hard shoe and one round of soft shoe. And so as a result, it is very easy to look at a boy dancer in a competition and hear like great rhythm and timing and volume and power, and to mark those things highly because they're really valuable in a hard shoe round, and to accidentally sum two rounds of hard shoe and one round of soft shoe up to a very high score for a boy, whereas a fabulous girl dancer who is more well-rounded among all of the skills, you know, may not benefit from the fact that, you know, if there were two soft shoe rounds, I think the boy points thing might go away, because there's sort of that sort of built-in weakness to the way we on average teach male dancers. That's my thinking. I don't know if that's right, but I suspect it's part of it. Becky or Casey, feel free to argue with me here if.
Well, I understand where you're coming from. I wasn't sure where you're going with we socialize them differently, but you explained it very well. And yeah, definitely. In my school and when I was in the short school and, you know, in other schools too, it's, I think there's a big appreciation for a masculine style of dancing, of the rhythm and, just the rhythm and the power and this like beautiful noise that comes from the feet, that we don't necessarily push on our female dancers as much. So I totally see where you're coming from. And then when there's two hard shoe rounds, then they could have the upper hand for that. Practically speaking, I've never given a boy a higher mark just because they're a boy. So if they have a lot of rhythm, it's like, and they miss any beats, then automatically they start to lose points with me. Whereas like girls, if they don't miss beats and, you know, if they have a lot of toe walks, they miss no beats almost, then they don't lose points on that side of things. So I don't think I do it. And I've never had trouble judging a mixed competition from my perspective at any level. And it's always been like a mixture of boys and girls in the throughout the whole result. So that's my perspective. Becky?
Yep, I don't find it an issue. And I really think particularly from beginner through to prelim, I mean, we're talking North American levels here, but you can put that on Europe if you want. The expectations are the same for everybody. You have to turn out, you have to cross, you have to have sound, you have to have pointy toes. Like sometimes I think it can be hard for dancers and families to accept that that's really it. Like there's no secret or special gimmick that is making the good dancers good. They're just doing that basic recipe of things consistently, every bar, every movement. And so girl or boy, or that's fine. I do have, well, I have strong opinions on a lot of things.
Let's hear
I
them.
Don't ever like boys to be punished. I would never over reward them, but I do feel disheartened when people, you know, maybe a boy wins the Oireachtas of two dancers and, well, they don't deserve to go to Worlds. There was only two kids. You know, I never want to begrudge the people that show up. Those boys, I'm sure, would be delighted to be in a competition of 150 people. So while I don't reward boys exceptionally, I also feel protective of the ones that show up, that they're not choosing the small number. So talking negatively about it, I think, is unfair to those kids that, or sorry, kids and adults that are showing up to dance.
I think,
and
you
I
may
really don't think, okay. I view Irish dancing as dancing, not a sport. And so for me, I don't mind mixed competitions. And I'll just say it, transgender dancers, you dance where you identify. That doesn't put me off at all.
And I think you, Becky, you nailed something that was really important, which is like, look, there is some differentiation by gender at the championship level, at the older teen level, etc. But I think something you noted, like at the beginner through even, you know, almost up to preliminary level, like there are the core skills. We are looking for the core skills, and it doesn't really matter who you are, or for that matter, what you're wearing, when you're looking for those core skills. Like, I don't think there is no differentiation at the championship level, but at the prize winner, you know, open prize winner level, like it's not a factor.
I agree, but I think even at the champ level and majors, there's style variation from schools and within female competitions. One school may be so graceful, so about the leg line, where one school is so about power and height. And those things can happen in an all-girls comp, girls to boys, whoever. So yeah, definitely there are other factors, I think, that come into play in the higher levels. But it's altogether fussier.
Okay. Any last opinions on that topic, or you want to move to the next one?
The only last thing that I was thinking of is I have seen some boys have an easier time with the bravado when they kind of walk on. And even when they dance, they're just like, yeah, it's bravado, it's confidence, it's their energy is a bit more, in a good way, a bit more cocky. But again, it goes back to the basics of like what you're actually judging, and you're judging the turnout and you're judging the posture and the timing and all that. But I think it's more that I would love to see some more girls have that type of bravado too, where it's like, this world is mine.
Okay.
Well, I always, if I could just hop in, just, this is sort of a funny story, but it goes with this. Like, I run stages a lot at the North Americans and at the Oireachtas and whatever. And can I just tell you that the environment I'm going to pick on a random age group just for the sake of our being here. The environment in backstage for an under 14 girls competition and an under 14 boys competition could not be more different on average. And I'm stereotyping here, but I don't think, as I look at everyone now nodding at me, suggests that I'm probably not wrong here, right? In the under 14 girls competition, every dancer is backstage and they look serious and they've got their headphones in and they're kicking their legs and they're not talking to each other, generally speaking. And everybody is super, super focused. And they walk on the stage, and I would say the average, My impression as the person working the stage is that the average feeling of the first round of, say, under 14 girls in the North Americans is a bundle of nerves. The under 14 boys competition, on average, and I'm stereotyping here, is the opposite. They are backstage. They are kicking a tape ball around playing soccer. We don't know who the next two dancers on the stage are. They may or may not be anywhere near the stage. They are just generally chaotic. But as a result, I would say the average feeling when they walk on the stage is a much calmer set of dancers. And I think that translates to what Casey just said, where it's like, there's there's, you know, maybe a difference in bravado on average that may have to do with how you stand backstage, how you prepare, what your mental headspace is, et cetera. I don't know how to fix it, but it is certainly an observation, and it's hilarious. For those of us running the stage, it's a pain in the rear end to try and figure out who's next on stage and why they're not standing next to the stage. But that's a separate issue. But that's certainly an observation that I've had, and I don't know if others have experienced this too.
I've had an under 14 boy backstage at the North Americans come out of line to tell me about the two fellas he's met by name and what they've chatted about midway through the round. So I agree. There's a lot of camaraderie there. You sort of have to send him back because he hasn't had his turn yet, but I'm delighted you've made friends.
Yeah, Brian, that's what I see in my class. So
yeah, it's okay to use the backstage time to just be
comfortable. Yeah, there's a lot of camaraderie there. It's very similar to adult dancing. Because you're this smaller pocket of people and they always see the same people, you just get to know each other better sooner, and that puts you at ease.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on TCRG to CEO Radio.